The vast city of white people that sprawled outside took its place. She was dead and he had killed her. He was a murderer. A Negro murderer. A black murderer. He had killed a white woman. He had to get away from here. Mrs. Dalton had been in the room while he was there, but she had not known it. But had she? No. Yes. Maybe she had gone for help. No. If she had known, she would have screamed. She didn't know. He had to slip out of the house. Yes. He could go home to bed, and tomorrow he could tell them that he had driven Mary home and had left her at the side door. In the darkness, his fear made live in him an element which he reckoned with as them. He had to construct a case for them. But Jan. Oh. Jan would give him away. When it was found that she was dead, Jan would say that he had left them together in the car at 46th Street and Cottage Grove Avenue. But he would tell them that that was not true. And after all, was not Jan a Red? Was not his word as good as Jan's? He would say that Jan had come home with them. No one must know that he was the last person who had been with her. Fingerprints. He had read about them in magazines. His fingerprints would give him away, surely. They could prove that he had been inside of her room. But suppose he told them that he had come to get the trunk. That was it, the trunk. His fingerprints had a right to be here. He looked round and saw her trunk on the other side of the bed, open, the top standing up. He could take the trunk to the basement and put the car into the garage and then go home. No, there was a better way. He would not put the car into the garage. He would say that Jan had come to the house and he had left Jan outside in the car. But there was still a better way. Make them think that Jan did it. Reds'd do anything. Didn't the paper say so? He would tell them that he had brought Jan and Mary home in the car, and Mary had asked him to go with her to her room to get the trunk, and Jan was with them. And he had got the trunk, and had taken it to the basement, and when he had gone, he had left Mary and Jan, who had come back down, sitting in the car, kissing. That's it. He heard a clock ticking and searched for it with his eyes. It was at the head of Mary's bed, its white dial glowing in the blue darkness. It was 3:05. Jan had left them at 46th Street in Cottage Grove. Jan didn't leave at 46th Street. He rode with us. He went to the trunk and eased the top down and dragged it over the rug to the middle of the floor. He lifted the top and felt inside. It was half empty. Then he was still, barely breathing, filled with another idea. Hadn't Mr. Dalton said that he did not get up early on Sunday mornings? Hadn't Mary said that she was going to Detroit? If Mary were missing when they got up, would they not think that she had already gone to Detroit? Yes. He could. He could put her in the trunk. She was small. Yes. Put her in the trunk. She had said that she would be gone for 3 days. For 3 days, then, maybe no one would know. He would have 3 days of time. She was a crazy girl, anyhow. She was always running with Reds, wasn't she? Anything could happen to her. People would think that she was up to some of her crazy ways when they missed her. Yes, Reds'd do anything. Didn't the paper say so? He went to the bed. He would have to lift her into the trunk. He did not want to touch her, but he knew he had to. He bent over. His hands were outstretched, trembling in midair. He had to touch her, and lift her, and put her in the trunk. He tried to move his hands and could not. It was as though he expected her to scream when he touched her. God damn. It all seemed foolish. He wanted to laugh. It was unreal, like a nightmare. He had to lift a dead woman and was afraid. He felt that he had been dreaming of something like this for a long time, and then, suddenly, it was true. He heard the clock ticking. Time was passing. It would soon be morning. He had to act. He could not stand here all night like this. He might go to the electric chair. He shuddered, and something cold crawled over his skin. God damn. He pushed his hand gently under her body and lifted it. He stood with her in his arms. She was limp. He took her to the trunk and involuntarily jerked his head round and saw a white blur standing at the door, and his body was instantly wrapped in a sheet of blazing terror, and a hard ache seized his head, and then the white blur went away. I thought that was her. His heart pounded. He stood with her body in his arms in the silent room, and cold facts battered him like waves sweeping in from the sea. She was dead. She was white. She was a woman. He had killed her. He was black. He might be caught. He did not want to be caught. If he were, they would kill him. He stooped to put her in the trunk. Could he get her in? He looked again toward the door, expecting to see the white blur, but nothing was there. He turned her on her side in his arms. He was breathing hard and his body trembled. He eased her down, listening to the soft rustle of her clothes. He pushed her head into a corner, but her legs were too long and would not go in. He thought he heard a noise and straightened. It seemed to him that his breathing was as loud as wind in a storm. He listened and heard nothing. He had to get her legs in. Bend her legs at the knees, he thought. Yes, almost. A little more. He bent them some more. Sweat dripped from his chin onto his hands. He doubled her knees and pushed her completely into the trunk. That much was done. He eased the top down and fumbled in the darkness for the latch, and heard it click loudly. He stood up and caught hold of one of the handles of the trunk and pulled. The trunk would not move. He was weak, and his hands were slippery with sweat. He gritted his teeth and caught the trunk with both hands and pulled it to the door. He opened the door and looked into the hall. It was empty and silent. He stood the trunk on end and carried his right hand over his left shoulder and stooped and caught the strap and lifted the trunk to his back. Now he would have to stand up. He strained. The muscles of his shoulders and legs quivered with effort. He rose, swaying, biting his lips. Putting one foot carefully before the other, he went down the hall, down the stairs, then through another hall to the kitchen, and paused. His back ached, and the strap cut into his palm like fire. The trunk seemed to weigh a ton. He expected the white blur to step before him at any moment and hold out its hand and touch the trunk and demand to know what was in it. He wanted to put the trunk down and rest, but he was afraid that he would not be able to lift it again. He walked across the kitchen floor, down the steps, leaving the kitchen door open behind him. He stood in the darkened basement with the trunk upon his back and listened to the roaring draft of the furnace, and saw the coals burning red through the cracks. He stooped, waiting to hear the bottom of the trunk touch the concrete floor. He bent more and rested on one knee. God damn. His hand, seared with fire, slipped from the strap, and the trunk hit the floor with a loud clatter. He bent forward and squeezed his right hand to his left to still the fiery pain. He stared at the furnace. He trembled with another idea. He could put her in the furnace. He would burn her. That was the safest thing of all to do. He went to the furnace and opened the door. A huge red bed of coals blazed and quivered with molten fury. He opened the trunk. She was as he had put her, her head buried in one corner and her knees bent and doubled toward her stomach. He would have to lift her again. He stooped and caught her shoulders and lifted her in his arms. He went to the door of the furnace and paused. The fire seethed. Ought he to put her in head or feet first? Because he was tired and scared, and because her feet were nearer, he pushed her in, feet first. The heat blasted his hands. He had all but her shoulders in. He looked into the furnace. Her clothes were ablaze, and smoke was filling the interior so that he could scarcely see. The draft roared upward, droning in his ears. He gripped her shoulders and pushed hard, but the body would not go any farther. He tried again, but her head still remained out. Now, goddamn! He wanted to strike something with his fist. What could he do? He stepped back and looked. A noise made him whirl. Two green burning pools, pools of accusation and guilt, stared at him from a white blur that sat perched upon the edge of the trunk. His mouth opened in a silent scream, and his body became hotly paralyzed. It was the white cat, and its round green eyes gazed past him at the white face hanging limply from the fiery furnace door. God! He closed his mouth and swallowed. Should he catch the cat and kill it, and put it in the furnace too? He made a move. The cat stood up, its white fur bristled, its back arched. He tried to grab it, and it bounded past him with a long wail of fear, and scampered up the steps and through the door and out of sight. Oh! He had left the kitchen door open. That was it. He closed the door, and stood again before the furnace thinking, cats can't talk.
This ends Disc 3. Native Son, Disc 4.
He got his knife from his pocket and opened it and stood by the furnace, looking at Mary's white throat. Could he do it? He had to. Would there be blood? Oh, Lord. He looked round with a haunted and pleading look in his eyes. He saw a pile of old newspapers stacked carefully in a corner. He got a thick wad of them and held them under the head. He touched the sharp blade to the throat, just touched it, as if expecting the knife to cut the white flesh of itself, as if he did not have to put pressure behind it. Wistfully, he gazed at the edge of the blade resting on the white skin. The gleaming metal reflected the tremulous fury of the coals. Yes. He had to. Gently, he sawed the blade into the flesh and struck a bone. He gritted his teeth and cut harder. As yet there was no blood anywhere but on the knife, but the bone made it difficult. Sweat crawled down his back. Then blood crept outward in widening circles of pink on the newspapers, spreading quickly now. He whacked at the bone with the knife. The head hung limply on the newspapers, the curly black hair dragging about in blood. He whacked harder, but the head would not come off. He paused, hysterical. He wanted to run from the basement and go as far as possible from the sight of this bloody throat, but he could not. He must not. He had to burn this girl. With eyes glazed, with nerves tingling with excitement, he looked about the basement. He saw a hatchet. Yes. That would do it. He spread a neat layer of newspapers beneath the head so that the blood would not drip on the floor. He got the hatchet, held the head at a slanting angle with his left hand, and after pausing in an attitude of prayer, sent the blade of the hatchet into the bone of the throat with all the strength of his body. The head rolled off. He was not crying, but his lips were trembling and his chest was heaving. He wanted to lie down upon the floor and sleep off the horror of this thing. But he had to get out of here. Quickly, he wrapped the head in the newspapers and used the wad to push the bloody trunk of the body deeper into the furnace. Then he shoved the head in. The hatchet went next. Would there be coal enough to burn the body? No one would come down here before 10 o'clock in the morning, maybe. He looked at his watch. It was 4 o'clock. He got another piece of paper and wiped his knife with it. He put the paper into the furnace and the knife into his pocket. He pulled the lever, and coal rattled against the sides of the tin chute, and he saw the whole furnace blaze, and the draft roared still louder. When the body was covered with coal, he pushed the lever back. Now. He shut the trunk and pushed it into a corner. In the morning he would take it to the station. He looked around to see if he had left anything that would betray him. He saw nothing. He went out of the back door. A few fine flakes of snow were floating down. It had grown colder. The car was still in the driveway. Yes. He would leave it there.
Jan and Mary were sitting in the car, kissing. They said, "Good night, Bigger." And he said, "Good night." And he touched his hand to his cap.
As he passed the car, he saw that the door was still open. Mary's purse was on the floor. He took it and closed the door.
"No. Leave it open."
He opened it and went on down the driveway. The streets were empty and silent. The wind chilled his wet body. He tucked the purse under his arm and walked. What would happen now? Ought he to run away? He stopped at a street corner and looked into the purse. There was a thick roll of bills, tens and twenties.
Good.
He would wait until morning to decide what to do. He was tired and sleepy. He hurried home and ran up the steps and went on tiptoe into the room. His mother and brother and sister breathed regularly in sleep. He began to undress, thinking,
"I tell him I left her with Jan in the car after I took the trunk down in the basement. In the morning, I'll take the trunk to the station, like she told me."
He felt something heavy sagging in his shirt. It was the gun. He took it out. It was warm and wet. He shoved it under the pillow.
"They can't say I did it. If they do, they can't prove it."
He eased the covers of the bed back and slipped beneath them and stretched out beside Buddy. In 5 minutes, he was sound asleep. Book 2. Flight. It seemed to Bigger that no sooner had he closed his eyes than he was wide awake again, suddenly and violently, as though someone had grabbed his shoulders and had shaken him. He lay on his back in bed, hearing and seeing nothing. Then, like an electric switch being clicked on, he was aware that the room was filled with pale daylight. Somewhere deep in him, a thought formed. It's morning. Sunday morning. He lifted himself on his elbows and cocked his head in an attitude of listening. He heard his mother and brother and sister breathing softly, in deep sleep. He saw the room and saw snow falling past the window, but his mind formed no image of any of these. They simply existed, unrelated to each other. The snow and the daylight and the soft sound of breathing cast a strange spell upon him, a spell that waited for the wand of fear to touch it and endow it with reality and meaning. He lay in bed only a few seconds from deep sleep, caught in a deadlock of impulses, unable to rise to the land of the living. Then, In answer to a foreboding call from a dark part of his mind, he leaped from bed and landed on his bare feet in the middle of the room. His heart raced. His lips parted. His legs trembled. He struggled to come fully awake. He relaxed his taut muscles, feeling fear, remembering that he had killed Mary, had smothered her,